Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, March 26th, 2015. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Chris Colby and I talk about whether to dump a suspicious beer or not, and Gary Glass helps us launch a contest that offers you a chance to win free registration at the National Homebrewers Conference in San Diego this June. You have a chance to win even if you've already registered. If you're new to homebrewing or would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm Basic Brewing, all one word. We have a Basic Brewing Radio and Basic Brewing Video page on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing. We're on the Google Plus as well. Thanks to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. You know how it works. Whenever you think of Amazon shopping, think of us first. Go to our website, basicbrewing.com, click on the Amazon ad at the right-hand side of the page. That will take you back to Amazon where you'll shop as normal. It won't cost you any extra, but you'll be helping us to bring you the show, and we greatly appreciate your support, helping us to buy plane tickets and such to go out to San Diego. We also have associate links for Brew Your Own magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on the site. You can find our Basic Brewing iPhone app on iTunes, our Android app on Amazon.com. We have a Windows Phone app. We're on the BlackBerry podcast directory, and we're in the Stitcher app as well. If you want to put a tip in our tip jar, some coinage in our guitar case, you can go to basicbrewing.com/support, and thanks to everybody who's done so already. And we have a sponsor this week, appropriately enough. Founded in 1978, the American Homebrewers Association is a thriving community of people who are passionate about beer and brewing. From expert homebrewers to folks who are just getting started with their first extract brew. More than 44,000 members rely on the AHA for money-saving member deals, event discounts, brewing resources, and general camaraderie. As a not-for-profit organization, the AHA relies on members to support their work to promote, protect, and grow the homebrewing craft. Support your passion and join your tribe. Visit homebrewersassociation.org and become a member today. Just like me. And speaking of the AHA, let's dive in, shall we? I spoke to Gary Glass, director of the AHA, about two pieces of good news. First, registration is still open for the National Homebrewers Conference in San Diego on June 11th through the 13th. They've reserved the entire facility out there, so there's plenty of room. And second, Gary has offered Basic Brewing Radio and Beer and Wine Journal two conference registrations to give away. So let's talk to Gary about the details. Gary Glass, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Hey, great to be with you, James.
Every time I look at the calendar, it gets closer and closer to June. It seems like the time is speeding up between now and then.
It always seems that way to me.
Especially if you've got this big event to take part in organizing and making sure everything is running on schedule. There's an exciting time coming up in San Diego, and the good news is, unlike some past years, there's still room for people to get in.
Yeah. We've got the entire Town and Country Resort in San Diego for the National Homebrewers Conference this year. Dates are June 11th through the 13th, it's going to be a fabulous time. We've got room for up to 4,000 attendees this year.
That's a lot of folks.
That is a lot of folks, but it is actually filling up. So if people are contemplating going, I would certainly recommend registering sooner than later.
And what is what's the website where people can go?
AHAconference.org.
And they can find all the information there.
Yep. There's the whole schedule of events and all the, there's several events that are going on around the conference to help attendees explore the awesome beer community that they have in San Diego. The list of we've got 54 different seminars spread across 9 different tracks, 108 different vendors in the Homebrew Expo. It's going to be awesome. More awesome than any previous conference, I guarantee.
And Club Night is going to be held outside this year?
Right. We're doing both the welcome reception and Club Night outside. Since we have the entire hotel to ourselves, we were able to use all of the facilities. And I'm sure you remember from when we were there in 2011, they have these beautiful gardens all around the hotel. So you got palm trees and birds of paradise and roses and all around the grounds. And so we can put up the club booths throughout the hotel, and you can just wander around and explore different homebrews. So, probably multiple thousands of homebrews being served on Club Night this year.
And in addition to the conference and all the seminars and all the homebrew that's going to be on tap there, it can't be set. Well, I don't want to say it can't be set in a better place, because then it'd make everybody outside of San Diego angry at me. But it's certainly one of the best beer destinations in the country.
Oh, yeah. There are over 100 breweries in San Diego County alone. certainly some very notable ones there. Stone Brewing Company, Green Flash, Lost Abbey, Ballast Point, Alesmith, and just so many more. And one of the beautiful things about the conference is that, during the welcome reception, we're going to have 50 plus of those breweries on site at the hotel.
Wow.
So you don't even have to go, you don't have to leave the hotel to experience what a great beer scene they have in San Diego.
And we always go a couple days early so that we can, take in a lot of the surroundings, because once the conference starts, you really don't want to leave. I mean, there's so much going on at the facility. But we had, the first night that we got there, there was an Irish pub. Is that where the happenings were?
O'Brien's?
That night? Yeah.
Yeah. O'Brien's is a pretty famous beer bar in San Diego, run by Tom Nickel, who's been a longtime brewer, owner of Nickel Brewing Company now, and just all around great guy. He knows way more than me about beer. So, that's certainly a place you want to check out if you're coming to San Diego.
And we had a lot of fun there. I kind of broke my rule about pacing myself, because the next morning came way early, and we drug ourselves to the Stone World Bistro. What's the official name? The Stone never remember.
Stone Gardens and World Bistro, I think.
Okay, well, I was closer than I thought.
So. Stone Brewery.
And I got some pasta and some. I got I think it was a Berliner Weiss from the brewery, which was a nice, low alcohol beer to have with my pasta. And I got charged up after that, and we went over to Lost Abbey / Port Brewing. And met up with one of the brewers there who listens to Basic Brewing Radio while he ran the bottling line, it turns out. So we had a lot of fun with that as well, and went to one of the pizza ports, it's just an amazing day. I should say that after the conference, my family flew in, and we had our family vacation there in the San Diego area afterwards. So, that's something to think about as well. You can dovetail family and homebrew, and then you can maybe feel a little less guilty about indulging yourself.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, San Diego, you've got the beaches, but also, their world-famous zoo, SeaWorld, Wild Animal Park, Legoland. They got the old town, Mexican restaurants, and just there's so much that you can do with a trip to San Diego.
And there's the weather was gorgeous, of course. So
right, it's San Diego. That's that thing, right?
We are going to meet up with a bunch of Basic Brewing Radio alums out there including Doug Warzynski and the Brulosopher and Tim Lieber, who's the mead maker, has promised to do another experiment for us, which has got me excited. And I think toxicologist Paul's going to be out there, and you know, I'm sure Zot O'Connor is going to be there, and you know, it's just an excellent opportunity to just gather, you know, who's who in the homebrewing community together, and learn about beer and talk about beer and sample beer and all that. Now, you told me something. You surprised me today with a special announcement that was something we haven't done before.
Yeah, yeah. Do you want me to say?
Yeah.
Or do you wanna...
I'm so excited.
We're giving Basic Brewing Radio 2 tickets to give away to your listeners.
That's amazing. I'm so excited. We're recording this a bit in advance because of this, of my spring break activities, but I'm going to get together with Chris Colby of BeerAndWineJournal.com, and you know, we can put our heads together and have some kind of fun contest where we can give away these two registrations. So I appreciate that a great deal, Gary. That's
absolutely.
It's an honor and a privilege to give those away.
Yeah. Well, and for anybody who's already registered, you know, if you happen to win, we'll certainly reimburse you the cost of the registration. So anybody and everybody should enter.
Cool. That's very nice. Added incentive for if you've already registered for the conference, you can wipe your slate clean, as it were.
Yeah.
Well, I can't. Like I say, I've been to every National Homebrewers Conference since Orlando in 2006. And they just keep getting better and more interesting. And, you know, homebrewers are great folks and talented and creative. And if you've never been to one of these things, if you're on the fence, go, because you'll never regret it.
Yeah, yeah. And then, and you'll meet people that will be your friends for life. I mean, there's, you know, thousands of homebrewers, and you know, meet the people whose books you've read: Randy Mosher, Ray Daniels, Gordon Strong, Jimmy Lozanischef,
John Chris Palmer.
Wright, John Palmer. They're all there every year and totally approachable. And you know, it's a one of a kind opportunity. There is no other event like it. It is, you know, definitely the event of the year for homebrewing. It's just no other place where you get that many homebrewers all together having that much fun.
Yeah. So say the website again.
AHAconference.org.
There you go.
Or you can get to it via our website, homebrewersassociation.org.
And I'll segue now to me to tell you the details of how you can get those registrations. Thanks, Gary.
Yeah, thank you, James.
Well, Chris Colby, pretty exciting news. Gary Glass and the American Homebrewers Association basically giving us two individual conference registrations to give away. And I want to partner Basic Brewing Radio with BeerAndWineJournal.com, because I think that is a perfect combination, don't you think?
Yeah, great. Thanks for including us.
Yeah. Well, the competition. Let's do a competition. Let's say we always do the homebrew disaster program every year at the end of the year, and it's awfully popular. And people send in their homebrew disaster stories. I want to do a flip side, kind of a yin and yang kind of a thing. You know, we do the funny bad side of homebrew disasters at the end of the year. Why don't we do something like homebrew heroics? How does that sound as an umbrella category? Homebrew heroics.
Yeah, the funny good side as a flip to the funny bad side. Sure.
And
Unless you want it to be the depressing good side. You know. Make it the exact counter.
So all the details will be on beerandwinejournal.com, along with the form where you can enter. But what we're looking for is an essay of 500 words or less. So we're being succinct. And it's based on the theme, homebrew heroics. And Chris and I will each pick our favorite entry. And it's just it's entirely subjective. It's just up to us. And, you know, we will each have an individual conference registration to give away. And then I'll throw some other consolation prizes in there as well, as like logbooks or and bottle openers such as that. And we will read the winners, our favorites, on beer and or on this show. What's it called? BasicBrewingRadio.com. And we will also post the entries in a story on BeerAndWineJournal.com. So pretty good.
Yeah, I think so.
And now there is one stipulation: you have to be a member of the AHA to go to the conference. So, and that is apparently thanks to the California law, the way it is now, members only are allowed to go to these homebrew events. And that's just the way the law is. That's not an AHA stipulation. That's just the way the law is structured. So you have to be an AHA member. Obviously, you have to be 21 or over. All the details of all that are going to be in the article on beerandwinejournal.com. So go to that and take a look at that. And send us your homebrew heroics story, and we hope to see you in San Diego. So very exciting.
Yeah, and homebrew heroics can be like anything.
Right.
Take heroics in the broadest possible sense. If maybe something was going bad on brew day and you came up with a, you know, solution to it, maybe you brewed a batch for some charity or something. You know, it's wide open.
Right. Yeah. It's up to your imagination. Homebrew heroics, whether you yourself as a homebrewer were a hero, or whether the homebrew that you brewed became the hero of a situation, or, you know, it's up to you. The theme is homebrew heroics in 500 words or less. So good luck, everybody. So there you go. Pretty exciting. Now we go to the deadline. I forgot about the deadline. The deadline for entries is April the 10th, and we will read and post the winners on the next week on the show that I will post on April 15th, which is officially the Thursday April 16th show. So. Jot that down on your calendar. April 10th is the deadline to send in your entry, 500 words or less, homebrew heroics, and enter to win one of two individual registrations to the National Homebrew Conference. Exciting stuff. Well, from the exciting stuff to the more mundane, Chris, we... We go to the topic of the articles that you wrote on Beer and Wine Journal. The title is "Should You Dump It?" And I have an example here from a letter from Joe. Not sure where Joe is from, but here's Joe's story. He said, "I've read about the banana flavors and all that are due to high fermentation temps. I'm doing a Kolsch with Y yeast, Kolsch yeast. Took a taste at primary to secondary transfer, tasted great. Took a taste at gravity reading, tasted great. On bottling day, I took a taste, tasted great. On my last bottle, while bottling it came up short, so I poured it in a glass, and there it sat for about 5 minutes. Then I took a drink, and it tasted like bananas. Do you think the whole batch will now taste like that?" So Joe was panicking, thinking his Kolsch was turning into more of a Hefeweizen, I guess, had more of a kind of a banana flavor. So my response was basically, let time, only time will tell, basically. And he wrote back, a couple weeks later, said it's been a couple of weeks and the off flavor went away. Good, clean, clear, crisp Kolsch. So there you go. There's an instance where a home brewer tasted something fair, you know, midway through the process, panicked, but everything came out right. So, is that basically is that a good example of what you were trying to illustrate in your stories?
Yeah, his story hits several high points of what I was trying to say, and you know, the overall idea of my article was that if something seems amiss in your homebrew, give it time, and maybe the problem will correct itself. And I mean, he mentions in there sampling it at several points when it seems okay. Then later on, a problem arose, but he waited it out, and things got better. And yeah, in my article, I mean, I go through there's all sorts of reasons why you might start to worry about a batch of homebrew that something's going wrong. It might be something you see, you know, a lot of times people after primary fermentation and most of the yeast drops out. Sometimes there's a couple colonies of yeast floating on top of their beer and they start to freak out. Or you might smell something, you know, if you're, an airlock sniffer, as they call them. you know, you might be trying a different yeast strain. And, you know, sometimes you can smell the gas coming out of the airlock. And sometimes it smells like, you know, fresh wort almost. And it's nice. And other times the smell coming out can about knock you over. And, you know, so some people will, they'll try out a new strain of yeast and something will seem off to them. Or, you know, of course, tasting, people will try to taste things and, especially when beer is very young, there's often a lot of green characters. There's, as you know, as, Joe in his letter said, there's characters that the yeast can later reduce. And, it comes up on, you see it on brewing forums all the time. People write in and frequently send a picture. And, you know, is my beer terrible? Should it be dumped? And really, you should there's a couple exceptions that I give in the article. But basically, unless you're absolutely sure that it's ruined, don't dump it.
Mm-hmm.
And the article basically goes through and tells you why you shouldn't be absolutely sure just because something looks a little different than it has looked before, because there's lots of reasons that something might seem to be off, but everything's still okay.
Yeah, let's go through each sense individually, and let's start with sight. People have sent me pictures of clumpy yeast in the carboy. You know, if you've started off with a with one yeast strain that doesn't clump as it works, and then you switch to another one that does, it can freak you out. You know, when you're looking in your glass carboy and you see, and it looks like a lava lamp with these huge pieces of whatever you want to call it, brown stuff floating around in there, it can be scary.
Yeah, it's really kind of amazing the diversity among yeast strains of how just a batch of beer looks when it's fermenting. Like, you know, commercial brewers, everything's done inside stainless and they don't really get to see it. But, you know, for home brewers, it's all right there. You know, if you use a carboy, just all you got to do is, you know, pull the T-shirt if you've covered the carboy, which you should to keep light out. But unless it's in somewhere where it's naturally dark. But yeah, you can just look and see your fermentation, and different fermentations, with different strains of yeast look very different. And really, there are very few beers that I would look at, see something visual, and want to dump it based on that. I mean, I'd say two exceptions. If you see something floating on top of your wort and it's like bright yellow or bright red or something, those are kind of colors that show up in some sorts of bacteria, which are not at all common as a brewery contaminant, but they're in the air. That would be a red flag to me. Although I don't even know if I've ever actually seen those. I've seen those. I just work in a lab and those showed up, and I know what they are, and you don't want to know what they are. Also, if you had a, if there's like a floating, you know, a little floaty island on top of your fermenter, if it starts to look, you know, filamentous, like hairy, like it's, then that's a mold, and that might be a cause for concern. Although, interesting enough, for stuff floating on top of your beer, if it was a mold, it would also probably mean there's a leak somewhere near your fermenter that air is getting in. Interestingly enough, I've had batches where something has gone wrong and something starts floating on top. I've racked the beer out from under it, and the beer under it was fine. You just sort of bottle as you go along, and you know, when you get sort of towards the part where you're now siphoning off the beer that's at the top, you know, you'll maybe indicate, you know, you'll maybe start smelling that this has gone bad. But, you know, in general, you know, and especially if you have never used a particular yeast strain before, I would never dump a batch based on the appearance of it.
Now, you can, some yeast strains, like, for example, I did a lager recently, and at the end of fermentation, there were little kind of flecks of Kroizen or yeast that didn't fall back into the beer, but they were just sitting on top of the beer. And I tasted the beer as I racked it. It tasted just fine. And I'm assuming that that's just, you know, just remainder of the fermentation process.
Yeah, a lot of people when they a lot of people when they see something floating on top of their wort automatically think it's a contaminant. But you know, yeast can clump together, and if at the time that they clump together, there's a couple of the cells in there, or a subset of the cells in there still fermenting, they can be producing a little bit of gas, and that will just sort of buoy that little clump of yeast up to the top. And, you know, and it can be just brewer's yeast. I mean, that happens all the time, and it's not a contaminant. And you know, doubly, especially if you look at it, and if it's like anywhere between like sort of cream white and, you know, that brownish look that the yeast get, there's that whole, you know, sort of the whole range of colors that the yeast can look. If it's in that range, it's probably your yeast, you know, unless something additionally like smells terrible. And, you know, but in the case of just seeing something floating that looks like it could be yeast, it's probably yeast.
Now, what if you have sort of a powdery residue on the top of your yeast, kind of a white, powdery, kind of bubbly thing happening on the top of your beer?
That can be yeast, some strains. That also, a powdery thing can also be, there are some contaminants that are aerobic, that if there's any air entering into the fermentation, it can grow sort of like a slime across the top that looks like it's sort of embedded with a white powder. And there, it would be good to like smell and see if it smells like vinegar. In that case, it's contaminated. But in that case, you can also, given that it's aerobic and needs air, the beer on top may be contaminated and smell like vinegar. But there's a chance that, because it takes time for molecules to diffuse through beer, there's a chance that you could rack the beer out from under that problem.
If you
catch it quickly.
If you want to see some pictures of something similar to what I'm talking about, Google the word pellicle, and look in homebrew forums for a pellicle. And there are some beers, sour beers and funky beers, where you want a pellicle developing on the top of your beer. But if you're just trying to make a nice clean pale ale, something's not going right if you get a pellicle on the top of your beer.
Right. There's a difference between some random floaties and a full blown, like, you know, there's a, it crusts over the entire top of your beer. Very definitely, yes.
And if you like sour beers and you accidentally make one, it might be good, but then it might not. It's kind of a crapshoot.
Yeah, accidental sours usually aren't great examples of what they're supposed to be.
So what about something, like you mentioned, something coming out of the airlock? If you're doing a lager, especially, you might get some sulfury smells that you're not used to. I noticed the first time I did a lager, I was like, "Whoo, that's different," you know. And I remember walking into a commercial brewery for the first time, and they were doing a lager. And I must have been the same yeast strain that I'd been working with or something similar, because there's that sulfury smell as well.
Yeah, that rotten egg smell. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, lagers kick off some terrible smells, the rotten egg sulfury smell. But different ale strains also at different times during the fermentation, and it's something that varies also with temperature, aeration, you know, all the pitching rate, all the sort of things that normally affect fermentation. Different ale strains will kick off different smells at different times. You know, there are some yeast strains that, you know, you can smell the beer mid fermentation. It just smells like, you know, fresh hops and fresh malt, and there's other strains that you smell it and it just, you know, you can't believe that this horrible smell is coming out of your airlock. And yeah, that can change over the course of fermentation too. And, you know, people, I think, you know, especially a lot of, you know, young homebrewers, people haven't brewed too much, you know, maybe they're using a different yeast strain and are used to, you know, a particular set of smells, might lean down and try to get a whiff of their airlock sometime and just be like, oh my God, something's horribly, horribly wrong. And it might be just, you know, just that's how that yeast smells at that given time. You can, if you're more of an advanced homebrewer and you've had some experience, you know, there are sometimes you can smell things that indicate problems, like something that's gone seriously sour will give off a smell. And if you're not wanting sour beers, that can be a warning sign. You know, sometimes it's hard to, you know, sometimes there are phenolic off smells that come out of the airlock that are just fine. But other times it's a result of, contamination or some other problem. And, you know, phenolics are pretty strong, odors. You know, in that case, it wouldn't necessarily, because you smell something phenolic, dump the batch, but you might at least want to make a note in your, you know, notebook that it smelled that way at this point. And then, you know, when you go to bottle it or keg it, check it, you know. But basically, there's a lot of weird smells that can come out of an airlock, and just, you know, especially if you, it's one thing if you brew the same beer over and over again with the same yeast, you know, and it's, then something weird shows up, you know, that might be a cause for alarm. But if you're just trying out a new yeast strain, you have no experience with it, and something smells like different in a way you've never smelled before, odds are it's probably nothing.
Sometimes, as Shrek said, better out than in. if the yeast are expelling it, and it's flying away from your fermenter, maybe that's a good thing.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. A lot of people think that, oh, if I'm smelling this from the airlock, it's going to mean the beer is permeated with this. But that's not necessarily the case. If you're smelling it, it's a volatile compound. And, you know, it's being expelled, and the churning motion of fermentation should continue to expel it. You know, if a really horrendous smell shows up later in fermentation, it's more of a worry because there's less sort of, you know, gas being expelled and stuff. But, you know, right around high Kreuzen, some ale strains, if you go ahead and smell to your airlock, are just, it's unbelievable that that you would ever drink what's in that carboy after you smell the airlock. You know, it's just like, whoa, geez.
Was that me?
Yeah.
Well, moving on to taste, which is, it might be more scary. If something tastes suspicious, you know, that may be more of an impetus to dump the whole batch.
Yeah, that's obviously, you know, you want beer to smell good and look good, but your primary goal in a beer is you want it to taste good. And if during the production of your batch, you taste it at some point and it tastes off, that might give you more reason to want to, you know, to say, oh, this this batch is bad and I'm going to dump it. But what I would say, if you, you know, there'd be two different sets of advice. One is if you're a new brewer and you don't have a lot of experience, I would just say, wait it out. There's, you know, as in the letter that we opened with this segment with, sometimes problems, you know, resolve themselves, or the yeast fix our problems for us. Other, as you get more experience, you're going to know when to worry about something. Like if you have if you've got a pale ale and, you know, a week after you've bottled it, it's already starting to taste sour, you're likely going to know, okay, sour is something that's just going to get worse and worse and worse. And then you either, you know, at that point you just have to decide, well, am I going to drink this pale ale now with a twinge of sour to it, or am I going to dump it? You know, and yet, you know, conversely, you'll also know some things, you know, if you have a pale ale and there's just a tinge of like diacetyl to it, you'll know, hey, if I store these bottles warm somewhere for a week or two, the yeast can take care of that, you know, depending on how strong the diacetyl is in your yeast strain. So, you know, yeah, my advice would be sort of two pronged. One, if you don't specifically know what the fault is and what its prognosis is, just give the beer a chance. You know, if you're an advanced home brewer and you know, you taste something like, oh, this is contaminated, it's got a very strong phenol flavor to it, you know, that's not going to get better with age. That, you know, that's not a green beer character that ages out. That's a contaminant that, if anything, is going to get worse, you know, then dump it. But for less experienced brewers, you know, give the beer a chance. A lot of homebrew things start out a little bit rough, you know, you know, things get better. The yeast clean up some problems.
Yeah, for example, speaking of yeast, if there's a bunch of yeast still in suspension, sometimes the yeast itself doesn't taste good. Like, for instance, I remember beers where there's kind of almost a rubbery taste in the beer when I was, you know, either racking it or maybe even bottling. But that went away after a while as the yeast kind of fell out of suspension.
Yeah, yeast will have also yeast will frequently be coated with molecules from the hop, so they'll taste very aggressively bitter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you'll be tasting some of the resins that from the hops that aren't really that good. Yeah, you should any taste that's going to be worth it should be the beer should be done fermenting. It should be, you know, have a reasonable amount of conditioning, and it also should be carbonated. I mean, sometimes. And it's weird. It kind of depends on the base beer, but sometimes just carbonating a beer can make it like seem 1,000% better.
Oh yeah.
It's hard to overestimate or oversell how much carbonation can improve a beer. So, you know, taking a cloudy sample, you know, at the time you're racking to secondary, the flavors you taste there might not be at all representative of what the final beer is going to taste. You know, so wait, if you're going to make a decision to dump a batch on taste, wait till the beer's been, you know, either bottled or kegged, had a reasonable shot at being conditioned and be carbonated, and, you know, and certainly not still, you know, cloudy with active yeast suspended in it.
Yeah, your beer is probably going to taste sweeter without carbonation. You know, in the beginning, I would taste beers and be like, "Oh, this is way too sweet." But then, you know, after you get a little bit of carbonation in there, it has a bite to it, you know, it can improve the beer quite a bit.
And also, yeah, the whole they'll taste also like fuller, like more. If you're trying to brew a dry beer without the carbonation, it's going to feel a little fuller, maybe even verging on like sort of almost I'm trying to think of the word.
Has a better mouthfeel. With,
yeah, homebrew with carbonation has like a little, sometimes a crispness, a zing to it that it, you know, a beer will taste like sort of flabby, quote unquote. uncarbonated, it really does make a difference. I think it changes the pH a little, even, because some of the CO2 is a small amount gets formed into carbonic acid, which changes the pH a little bit, which is likely going to improve your beer unless the pH was too low already. So yeah, wait till you have a sample of the beer that's like reasonably likely to be representative of what your finished beer is going to taste like before you judge it.
I have a couple of weird examples of beers that I didn't dump, and I was happy I didn't. We made we called it melon blood beer, where we used didn't use any water. In the brewing of this all grain beer, we just used watermelon juice for all the brewing water. The beer initially, you know, when we tasted it a couple of weeks after bottling, we didn't like, but I refused to give up on it because we, you know, had done so much work on this and it was such a unique beer. And a few months later I revisited it and it had dried out, and some of the weird flavors that we were tasting had, I guess, either gone away or the yeast took care of it or it settled out or whatever. But it was actually a whole lot better than in the beginning, and it was actually not a bad beer. It was really interesting, kind of fruity and really kind of an enjoyable beer. The other one that comes to mind is one that I brewed with. I took the dregs of an Orval and put them in a little starter and built them up, and then transferred that to a bigger starter, and I wound up brewing a 5-gallon batch of pale ale with the yeast essentially from this Orval, and I didn't age it very long in the fermenter. I just treated it like a standard pale ale, and the beer that I bottled a couple of weeks after bottling, you know, it tasted like a nasty shower drain or something. It was just it tasted like a foot. It was not good at all. But again, I said, doggone it, I'm not going to give up on it. And so a few months later, I came back to it and it tasted better. It tasted more like an Orval. It had kind of more of a floral Brett character, and was crisp and actually a whole lot better. And I actually chilled one down. And I forgot to bring it up. I was going to taste it here on the show to see what it was like. But every time I've tasted it since then, it's gotten a little bit better. So those have, you know, I've had those in the bottle for a few years now. So that's a weird example, and probably one that you might not come across on your own. It may be atypical, but it's another instance of, you know, something that did get better over time instead of getting worse.
Yeah, those are two interesting examples, because in one you used an ingredient that's not normally used in homebrewing. And when you do that, you know, especially if you put fruit in a batch, the way that the fruit flavors evolve over time can change. And, you know, it might, you know, just like a lot of wines, wine generally isn't served, you know, 2 weeks after it's done fermenting. They let that age out. If you make fruit beers, sometimes it's going to take a little while for the fruit flavors and aromas to sort of stabilize. And you know, who knows even what the yeast are doing, taking in and processing these, you know, different components of the fruit. And in the second case, you know, you had an Orval clone. So there was, you know, some, you know, very slow fermentation still going on in the batch. And, you know, yeah, with sour beers, yeah, you sort of all the rules of normal beer brewing, or not all of them, but many of them sort of get thrown out the window, at least with regard to like conditioning. But yeah, so that would be another reason. If you use weird ingredients, or if you expect, you know, if you're brewing a sour beer, you know, definitely if you're brewing a sour beer, don't put all the, you know, the time and effort that it takes to age that thing out and just like all of a sudden one day say, oh, I'm getting rid of it, you know, because it, you know, there are stages in lambic production that if you would taste a lambic, you would probably, you know, hurl, you know, literally you'd just be like, oh my God. But that, you know, that ages out, and then the microorganisms because there's in a lambic production, there's, you know, the brewer's yeast goes full tilt at first, and then later on, the lactic acid bacteria start working and are sort of the dominant microorganisms. Then it's later on, it's the Brett, you know, and those two are they're blended into each other, and it's not you know, a complete changing of the guard every time. But the you know, and then you know, late in fermentation, there can be other microorganisms just ticking along. If you've got the beer style series, if you got the Lambic book by Guinard, he goes all on and on about the succession of different microorganisms that come to the forefront in a lambic fermentation. It's kind of interesting. But yeah, sour beers are a whole other thing.
And speaking of which, I finally pitched my I made a starter from my you know, I took a yeast out of my garden and stuck it in a small starter, or took a fig out of my garden that I hope would have yeast on it, and put it into a small starter and put that on a stir plate, and I got some active fermentation, and it smelled funky, and then it smelled nice, and then so I was scared of it, you know, of what to do with it, and so I finally pitched it into a larger batch of about 3 quarts, and that was a while back, and I took a gravity reading, and you know, there was something going on in there, but I took a gravity reading and it hadn't moved very much, and so I texted Michael Tonsmeyer, which is one benefit of the show, as I could I have ready access to a sour beer expert. And I told him, you know, the situation, and he said, well, you know, that doesn't – I asked him, you know, basically if I should taste it. And he said, well, it probably hasn't, you know, fermented – you know, the pH probably hasn't come down enough, and it probably hasn't fermented enough to be, you know, absolutely safe. He said, what's it smell like? And I said, well, it kind of smells like bread. And he said, well, it doesn't sound bad. So I was going to throw it out, but I kept it. And in fact, I swirled it up and it grew a new pellicle on top, and it's got more activity. So who knows what's going to happen with that. But the thing is, you know, it's in a 1 gallon jug and it's not taking up much space. And why should I throw it out? If it's not, if it's not dangerous, it's not hurting anybody. You know, who knows what's going to happen with that thing. So anyway, I don't know if that's germane to the topic or if that's a bunny trail to run down, but, I just thought I'd give an update on where that project is.
Yeah, it's interesting. Because like most yeast strains, like wild yeast strains and most bacteria in the world will die in a solution. If the alcohol percentage gets over a couple points, you know, 2 or 3% is enough to kill off most strains. And so, you know, most just random wild strains of microorganisms don't do well in a fermentation setting. And so, you know, like even winery for there, you know, there are some wineries that sort of do, you know, quote unquote natural fermentations, you know, using the Saccharomyces. That's, you know, in that case it's even the right yeast strain, but a wild version of it, and try to ferment their yeast, and they find it a lot of times it's under attenuated because it's, you know, strains that are used in breweries and wineries, you know, they've been selected over time to be able to tolerate greater and greater amounts of ethanol, and likewise the contaminants that you find in breweries have been selected, you know, time and time to be able to live in higher higher alcohol and lower pHs. I mean, it's not a complete coincidence that, you know, one of the types of brewery contaminants is lactic acid bacteria. You know, lactic acid bacteria is used to sort of poisoning their environment with acid and outcompeting other organisms that way. So brewing was sort of a, you know, that was a you know, open niche for them when people started brewing and making wine. So yeah, no, I think that's interesting. I think all the stuff about sour beers and trying to get that going is interesting. I mean, one thing, if I was making a sour beer from a wild sample, I would probably want to pitch, you know, maybe give it a day or two to let whatever is growing naturally on the sample, get going, and then I'd maybe pitch some actual brewer's yeast to it afterwards to make sure that the fermentation actually goes somewhere. That would be, I don't know, what I would do. Not that that's the right way to do it, but it's a way to do it.
Well, and the jury is out still on this thing, whether my fig beer will be a real thing or not. But it's a new adventure. It's fun. It's a fun thing to do.
Yeah.
Well, sir. Speaking of new thing to do, we've got to hammer out the details of the website and such, so that when people hear this episode, they can run to beerandwinejournal.com and fill in their story of their homebrew heroics and enter to win one of the two free conference registrations. And, even if you've entered, as Gary said at the beginning of the show, even if you have entered and paid for a conference registration already, if you win this, you'll get a refund. So that's cool.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That is cool.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Yes, sir.
Can I say one last thing?
Sure.
One thing I would recommend to all brewers is you can save your 99% of the time. You can save yourself the worry of if anything's going wrong by simply pitching enough yeast. Usually when a fermentation occurs and a beer sort of smells rough or off or not quite good and it cleans up later, it's almost invariably the case that the person didn't pitch enough yeast to start with. You can, I know making a yeast starter is a hassle, or buying extra smack packs or things of yeast is more expensive. But really, if you hit your wort with enough yeast, like 9 times out of 10, that ensures that your fermentation is going to go. It's going to start quickly. It's going to, go directly to your final gravity. The yeast will flocculate out. It'll, if it's an ale, it's going to condition fast. It might even be conditioning can even be done like right at the end of fermentation. And if not, in most cases, a couple of days is really all you need for most ales, unless they're very strong. You can save yourself a lot of headaches, sometimes even literally, by figuring out how much yeast you need to pitch and pitching that amount of yeast.
Good advice. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Very exciting indeed. This is the first time that we've done something like this. So to recap, to enter the contest and to win one of two free registrations to the National Homebrewers Conference, go to beerandwinejournal.com. Look for the blog post about the competition or the banner at the top of the site that will take you to the entry form. Fill out the entry form with your story of homebrew heroics by April 10th. We won't accept entries through email or any other method. You have to be a member of the AHA to attend the conference. That's thanks to California law. And, of course, you have to be 21. Chris and I will each pick our favorite entry to win one of the two conference registrations. That prize includes full conference registration and a ticket to the banquet. No hotel or any other travel expenses are included. Check out beerandwinejournal.com for full details. Good luck, everybody. Looking forward to reading your entries on the April 16th Basic Brewing Radio and on beerandwinejournal.com. In the meantime, if you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form at basicbrewing.com, and please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our support link, where you can throw a couple of bucks into the tip jar by subscribing financially to our podcasts. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site. You can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store as well. You can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order them online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We greatly appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Grizzly H8089 1250-pound low-profile transmission jack and 1,500 thread count, California king size, four-piece bed sheet, Egyptian comfort deep puck burgundy. Thanks again, everybody. Remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site. The next time you feel like Amazon shopping, we greatly appreciate your support. You'll be helping to send us to the Homebrew Conference. And don't forget, you can also join the American Homebrewers Association and subscribe to Brew Your Own magazine as well through associate links on basicbrewing.com. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.